Tonight on Arena, we remember poet Michael Longley, who has died at the age of 85. And in film, we review The Brutalist and Presents and look at today's Oscar nominations. #51551 is the text. You'll get us on socials at RTE Arena. Well, sad news earlier today with the announcement of the death of poet Michael Longley, who was 85. He survived by his wife Edna, a daughter and two sons, and indeed grandchildren. He leaves behind a considerable legacy in terms of poetry, some 12 collections, as well as a selected volume, Ash Keys, which came out last summer. Michael was part of a gifted generation of Northern poets, names such as Seamus Heaney and Derek Mahon, with whom he will forever be associated. He was born in Belfast in July 1939, and he spent most of his life in that city. However, choosing to read classics at Trinity College Dublin as a young man was to prove a significant choice, personally and professionally for him. It was there that he began to write poetry in earnest, and there that he met his wife, Edna. He was also a regular visitor to the west of Ireland. He has given us more than 50 years of poetry since his debut collection, No Continuing City, in 1970. And Longley's lifelong themes include nature, love, sex, war, politics, the ancient Greeks, the North, and his beloved County Mayo. Poet Pat Bourne joins me now on the line. But before we speak to Pat, let's hear from Michael Longley himself. He was a guest on Arena during the summer in July of last year. In fact, when Ash Keys, a new selected poems, was published in honour of his 85th birthday. Here he introduces and reads a poem set in Dublin from the early 1970s.
Well, I wrote this poem, I suppose, in my early 30s. That's a long time ago. And it was inspired by sitting on a bench at the Grand Canal in Dublin on a Sunday afternoon walk. And lo and behold, two swans very obligingly stopped swimming past me and proceeded to mate, which was an extraordinarily dramatic sight. And I turned it into a love poem called Swans Meeting. And it's a poem, to be honest with you, that I'm so fond of. When I can't get to sleep, it's one of the poems I recite in my head. Even now, I wish that you had been there, sitting beside me on the riverbank, the cob and his pen sailing in rhythm until their small heads met and the final heraldic moment dissolved in ripples. This was a marriage and a baptism, a holding of breath, nearly a drowning, wings spread wide for balance where he trod, her feathers full of water and her neck under the water like a bar of light.
Michael Longley there reading his poem Swans Mating, a poem from 1970. Michael Longley's death was announced today. He was 85. Pat Bourne joins us on the line to talk about the legacy and the achievements of Michael Longley. I mean, you listen to that poem, and because you're hearing Michael Longley, the older man, reading the poem, Pat, you hear it in a different way. But that was the poem, an early poem, and the very well-achieved poem of a young poet.
He came out, as they say, fully formed. And the thing is, hearing that and hearing him read that, you realise what people say, what they mean when they say the poet's voice. It's not only the authority and the vision, but in Michael's case, it's literally that. It's literally the voice, the modulation, the cadence. He had a fantastic, hypnotic voice, and he had it because I think he was so immersed in music. I remember the first time I came across his poems, I was in London. I bought his poems 1963 to 83. I have it in front of me here, in 1985 in Covent Garden. And what really struck me about it, I only vaguely knew who he was, to tell you the truth. I was only in my early 20s. But what I loved about it was there were so many poems about jazz. Michael was a real jazz aficionado, and there are poems about Billie Holiday and Jelly Roll Morton and all sorts of people. And that absorption of those rhythms, those cadences, and that play that happens between one line and another, the call and response of jazz. That's very much part of Michael's makeup. The earlier poems are a little bit more formal, and the rhymes are a bit, you know, they're a bit more on the surface. But as he said at one stage, that when he got better at it, he was able to bury the kind of the metronome, the pacemaker of rhyme, as he called it. Yes. He was able to hide it. But the music is there from the start, and it's the music that he trusted more than anything. Yeah. He followed the poems into territories that and he didn't always know where they were going to bring him.
Yeah, he also was very clear when he spoke. It was Aidan Gormley who was in the seat back last July. When he spoke with Aidan about the collected, the recent collected, selected and collected, which was called Ash Keys, he was very clear about, as you said, that cadence is important, but not a word too much. And always remember, it's a poem, so there's lots of white space that should be visible on the page. Let's listen to what he said.
I think chattiness, verbosity are bad influences in poetry. They're the opposite of poetry. In a mysterious way, the white space around the words in a poem are nearly as important as the words themselves. And when the words themselves make themselves heard, they're shattering that silence and filling that whiteness. So it's a question of knowing what to leave out, as much as how much to put in.
And that's Michael Longley there speaking to Aidan Gormley back last July about the absence of chattiness.
I was going to say there, it's very interesting that you pick that, because there is one early poem about Emily Dickinson, and he says, "Yours is always a perfect progress through such cluttered rooms to eloquence, delight, to words, your window and the mystery." You know, he recognised, as I say, came out fully formed. He recognised early on that it's about that stripping down. And he got braver in that sense as a poet. He trusted his audience in a way that, you know, the would-be poets and the more amateur poets and the more doubting poets and self-doubting poets maybe don't always know how to do. He left space for the reader to enter the poems, and he gave them credit for things that they hadn't yet discovered, because he had just discovered them himself.
The other aspect I think that's important in all of this is, you know, you talked about the jazz. You were kind of surprised by the presence of so much kind of jazzy influences in that early, that 1963 to 83 collection, if I have the dates right on
that's
it.
That's right.
That you spoke about, Pat. He was also very, very broad ranging in terms of his themes. Yes, nature was important, but you heard what he did. We heard in that first poem what he did with the swans. But there were First World poems in there, or First World War poems in there, or certainly a reference to First World War poetry and earlier poetry.
Well, that's right. I interviewed him back in the 90s, mid-90s, maybe 95 for Books Ireland. And it was either Gorse Fires or The Ghost Orchid. I can't remember which. And the book contained a poem that opens, "I am walking into the backwards." I'm walking backwards into the future like the Greeks. And the idea of the poem was that the poet is kind of dislocated, and he or she sees things by being dislocated. And Michael's poems often went back into one past, but what they were doing was they were actually mining another past. You know, you mentioned at the start he was born in 1939, just 2 months before the war. Mm. So he was a Second World War baby, but so much of his writing was preoccupied, concerned and preoccupied, and exploring, archaeologically exploring the effects of the First World War. And in that interview with me, he explained that. He said that he couldn't write directly about the Troubles, but that all of these poems were essentially about the Troubles. They were his diagonal approach. So he was looking for the occasion of early on of violence, but then of healing and the possibilities of healing. And he could only really approach those outside of his own immediate experience, if you like. And I think poems often work like that, that poets and poetry tends to see things in the margins, that you follow one thing and you find other things. So, for instance, you know, you mentioned him as a nature poet, as a kind of an ecological poet. But what's amazing, I think, about those ecological poems is that often what he's doing is he is just sitting looking at something. And he's just seeing, and that's the honouring of the poem. Mm. And he's not saying we need to do this. It's not a clarion call to say we need to protect the environment. It is, in fact, the interaction with the environment. It is the expression of love.
Yeah.
And so many of the poems are almost reduced to lists. I mean, he loves the names of plants, whether it's the Linnaean names, you know, the botanical names, or something local in the mythology, in the cartography, in the Dinshanakas of the place. He delights in those, but he also knows that those names are a way of protecting places.
Yeah.
They have a kind of a magic about them. Well, and you can hear him delight in that magic.
Yeah, and in fact, you're talking there about the natural world. We're going to talk about the celestial world in the final poem that I want to play from him, which is a more recent poem, Amelia's Model, which is about his granddaughter. Pat, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
There's so much more we could say about the ceasefire poem, for instance, etc. There's so much to Michael Longley. Mm. And I think, you know, whatever else this is, it's a sad moment, but it also should be the beginning of a celebration and an invitation to go and read the poems.
Go read the poems. That's always the best way you can honour a poet, isn't it? Or any writer, indeed, is to read the material rather than just find out about the man or the woman. Pat, thanks for being with us this evening.
Thanks as ever, Sean.
And that's Pat Boren remembering Michael Longley. We'll finish with Michael Longley himself and a poem he wrote for his granddaughter. And as I said, it is called Amelia's Model. He introduces it himself.
This is a poem about my granddaughter. When she was about 10, she made a model of the universe out of wire and buttons. Amelia's Model. In her model of the solar system, my seven-year-old cosmologist ties to a barbecue skewer with fuse wire the planets, buttons for Venus, an ivory button, Mercury silver beside the sun, mother of pearl for Jupiter, red and green for Mars and Earth, for Saturn's rings, a pipe cleaner, so that in the outer darkness, close to the kitchen, her brown eyes represent Uranus, Neptune. Amelia, you didn't include Pluto in your wire sculpture of the solar system. Tiny and very far away, an ice world of ice mountains and methane snow, a dance of five moons unlit by the sun, the god of the afterlife's kingdom. We shall go there when we die, dear child.
Michael Longley reading his poem Amelia's Model there. He was born on July the 27th, 1939, and died on January the 22nd, 2025. Yes, je love je, grow anam gilish. +51551 as always is the text at RTE Arena on socials, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. And joining me and sitting in their seats in studio now are Paul Whittington and Ruth Barton, who will be doing our film reviews for us this evening. Before we get to that, the Oscar nominations were announced at lunchtime today. Not quite the Italian 90 scenario of recent years for Irish film, it has to be said, but we should note the Irish production company Tailored Films got two nominations for The Apprentice, with former Arena guests Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan getting nominations for their roles as Roy Cohn and Donald Trump. no question, Paul, but Kneecap was, we were all hoping there'd be a nod either for
Yeah, they had two chances. Yeah. I actually thought that they might have had a better chance with the song because I thought the other one was a long shot.
The best international film.
Yeah, to be honest. But obviously it would have been wonderful because it's such a, you know, it's such a vivacious film, if you like, and it's Oscar-ing as well, isn't it? And so it would have been lovely in a slow year. We've been spoilt in recent years, but it was not to be.
Yeah.
Emilia Perez is the big story of it because it got 13 nominations, and I wonder why it would have got 5. Never mind 13. It's a very unpopular.
Everybody's talking about that. It's you know, you either love it or hate it.
It's, well, it's a very unpopular film in Mexico because Jacques Audiard, who's the director, I really admire. He has openly said, oh, I didn't really bother investigating the whole of Mexican side of things, and it really has caused problems there. Yeah. Its attitudes to various things have made it unpopular in certain quarters. But I think it, and you mentioned The Apprentice there. I have a feeling that part of these nominations represent Hollywood's response to the election of the president.
Well, I was wondering precisely the nomination of Carla Sofia Gascon as the first trans woman, first ever trans performer to be Oscar nominated. A direct response to President Trump's speech, perhaps the other day, Ruth, would you say?
I think it's both a direct, it's raising the finger to Trump, but I think it's also raising the finger to Hollywood's own history of ignoring, diversity, and also the kind of long critique of the Oscars of ignoring diversity, or being very, very kind of limited in who they choose. So it's also the Oscars, I think, showing that they are diverse and they are open to multiple different types. And then, of course, it's California saying, you're not our president. She probably won't get a like, what happens when she goes to LA, what will happen?
Yeah. Best Picture, Anora the Brutalist, A Complete Unknown, Conclave, Dune Part 2, Emilia Perez, I'm Still Here, Nickel Boys, The Substance, and Wicked. Mm. A lot of people saying that it's the film that people will be least annoyed by that's going to win there.
Yeah, well, you do tend to get that. You tend to get the more controversial ones being brushed aside, and a middle running a film coming through, like maybe something like Conclave, which
a lot of people were talking about that today. I was listening to several commentators saying Conclave.
Conclave was a very, very enjoyable film, very ingeniously made. I think we reviewed it, did we? Ray Fiennes would obviously be he has a chance. I mean, Adrian Brody does particularly. I mean, The Brutalist is one of those films that is made for awards. I mean, if it hadn't got 10 awards, everybody would be saying, why not? Big, heavy, 3.5 hour epic, full of ideas. It's the kind of film the Academy loves. But I mean, what Dune Part 2 is doing in there, I have no idea.
I mean, we'll talk a bit more about The Brutalist because obviously it's part of our film reviews this evening. I should say, by the way, Carla Sofia Gascon very clearly would have got the nomination, I think, no matter who was the president, no matter who said what.
No, I think
she has been nominated for and won awards all along the way.
Yeah, and she's a very accomplished actor as well.
Yeah, it's not the first time. Is there a category that's the one that you're thinking, well, who on earth is going to come out of that? I mean, best actor and best actress in the leading role both look fairly competitive.
Yeah, I think obviously there's a few. I mean, I think Nicole Kidman's nose might be able to join, but I don't think she deserves to be there.
Demi Moore in The Substance, a lot of people saying, please, she deserves
I think that, I mean, I'm not saying sentiment because she's been good in a few other things in the last few years, but I think that she might be in with a chance there. I mean, to be honest, for me, Cynthia Erivo, it's the kind of film that doesn't tend to do well at the Oscars even now because it's too mainstream, but I think she was wonderful. So that's a very interesting one. I think the leading actor, we mentioned Ralph Fiennes. I mean, I don't think The Apprentice, I don't think it was a very good film, to be honest. So I'm sorry about that. But I think that it could be between Adrian Brody and Ralph Fiennes.
We'll be talking about Adrian Brody. Was Selena Gomez a bit hard done by? I mean, I know you didn't like Emilia Perez, the film, but Selena Gomez.
I think this does go back to what Paul was saying about the backlash to the film in Mexico. And when I was watching Emilia Perez, I did find Selena Gomez uncomfortable in her delivery of her lines, and I thought you know, it's an odd thing. Okay, she's Latino,
yeah, she
had to relearn Spanish to perform the part. And there's something for me. She actually wasn't quite right in the role for me. So I'm not terribly surprised that she was excluded. I mean, I'd really go for Mikey Madison in Enora. I liked Enora very much, and I thought she was really good in it. So, you know, left field a bit, but
and Yura Borisov is up in the supporting actor one as well, which is interesting because I think that Edward Norton was excellent in the Bob Dylan film, that he was brilliant. But
complete
I think
unknown. What about Kieran Culkin in A Real Pain?
Yeah, he is that's a lot of people love that film. He's really good at it. But actually, Guy Pearce in the film we're about to discuss is really good.
So good,
I think if he won it, nobody would moan.
And let us not forget. Yes, Saoirse Ronan and Cillian Murphy were not nominated, but they were shortlisted, and that in and of itself that we were in that shortlist along with the kneecap guys.
I think neither of the films they were nominated for had traction, as they say in America. So that was always going to be an uphill task for them. Yeah.
But congratulations to all involved, and we shall obviously be watching.
We will
over the next while. As when is that?
March 3rd or something. Is it second?
Yeah. March 2nd. Oh. I'm being told in my ear is the date of that particular event. Okay, let us go on to the film reviews then, and sure we might as well start with The Brutalist. 10 Oscars nominations, I think, as you said, Paul. In pole position to actually win quite a few, tells the story of a fictional Bauhaus-trained Jewish-Hungarian architect, Laszlo Toth, played by Adrian Brody, and his life in America after enduring the horrors of wartime Europe. We'll also be talking about The Presence, a ghost story from Steven Soderbergh, with the stars Lucy Liu, and it's interesting things to say about perspective and point of view when it comes to that. But The Brutalist, real stylistic throwback, apart from anything. 3.5 hours, intermission in the middle, out you go, get a coffee, have a break and go back in. And it's in VistaVision. You might explain the VistaVision to us and why that is important. You have to see this in the right cinema, I'm guessing.
Ideally see it in 70mm. But the thing about VistaVision is that where film is fed vertically, normally, if you're shooting on film at all, which most people don't know. So normally film, when it was celluloid, is filmed vertically going down a camera lens, but VistaVision is filmed, the strip actually moves horizontally across the lens of the camera. So it's very, very, very different. Nobody shoots in VistaVision. And it was more for Westerns and
it's
so on.
It's built for bigness.
For the scale.
I'm trying to see how Vista is saying isn't it? You know, and you can sense how going horizontally would give you that wider kind of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And as Ruth says, 70mm is the way to see it. And the IFI are showing 70mm. But it's a big film in every sense. It reminded me a good deal of There Will Be Blood, the Paul Thomas Anderson film. And it is about America, but not just America. It's about what happened to America just after the Second World War and about creativity. Lots of ideas in this film.
And I'm guessing, you know, it's the oldest one in the book, isn't it? You're writing an historical novel, you're writing about today, you make an historical film, you're making a film about today as well. This is very much about how migrants are treated in the case of the Laszlo Toth character.
Yeah,
you think he's been treated well, but there's lots of stuff going on in the background.
Well, I think Adrian Brody is really, really good in this. He suffers like no one else. He's almost like a passion play. He's like a messiah in the middle of it. And he comes to America. The first thing he sees, for some reason, is the Statue of Liberty upside down, which gives you some idea of the obstacles he will encounter. He doesn't speak English very well. He goes to Philadelphia to his cousin. Attila, who has tried to blend in, he calls his shop. He has a furniture shop. He calls it Miller and Sons, is it? I think. And he's converted to Catholicism to marry his shiksa wife. And he doesn't tell people that he's a Jew because that's not a terrific thing to be in post-war America. And Laszlo is much more kind of, I wouldn't say literal minded because he's so creative, but he can only be Laszlo. He can't be anybody else. So that lands him into all sorts
of
problems.
And he's kind of taken under the wing of the Guy Pearce character, Van Buren, who who looks as if he's giving him a good time and looking after
yeah,
him.
Yeah, I mean, beware millionaires, I think, is one of the messages of this.
Don't get to meet too many of them, Ruth.
No, it's not actually something I worry about too often. Then. Or even being, you know, coming under the patronage of a millionaire. But this is, of course, what happens in the film. So he, you know, once he's been working with his second-rate cousin in the second-rate furniture store, and they get a surprise commission to design a new library for Van Buren.
Well, let's listen to that moment when an elated Guy Pearce as Van Buren tells assembled acolytes of an exciting new commission.
It is no coincidence that fate brought us together on the eve of my mother's death. I'm good at reading the signs.
Sir, I do not know what the commission entails.
We'll talk about the details at home, but you'll be well compensated. And also, you'll be given a place here on the property to live and work. I think that residing here will allow you the time and the space to conceive of it properly. And your family, should they arrive, they're welcome here too. What do you say?
I would like to draw something and present it to you.
You'd like to win the commission. All right, you can do that. It's cold. Let's return inside. Come on.
There we are, Guy Pearce taking on that commission in the Brutalist End. I think it was Adrian Brody that he was kind of getting.
Yeah, this is
not getting overexcited about the fact that he had a commission.
This big pitch is being made to him. What happened first was that he was asked to design the library, but it was by Van Buren's children, and he hated and kicked him out. And 3 years later, he finds him, by which time poor old Lazar has become addicted to heroin and is working on a coal heap. So he takes him back, he commissions him to build this massive monolithic structure on his land.
Adrian Brody carries the film, I think it's fair to say, but we heard from Felicity Jones and Guy Pearce on the programme last night about their roles in the film. Very interesting. All three of them up for nominations, and lots of nominations for the film. Is this a winner? Not just in terms of the Oscar nominations, but as
actually
as
just
a
going
watch.
To see it. Yeah. Oh, I really recommend that people go to see it. One of the things we were kind of chatting about it outside, and there's so much you can say about it. Like we can't even fit in this program even a fraction of the interesting things that emerge out of watching it.
Yeah.
It is a long film, but it's also a really rich film in terms of ideas and themes. So I think, you know, go to see it. Leave time afterwards for the cup of coffee or the glass of wine or whatever, and you'll really. You know, you can really dive into it and get a lot from it.
Stars from you on this one, Ruth?
I gave it 4.5. I had a couple of tiny quibbles, but I think it's really immersive.
As you said, Brody does carry the film. The film carries itself, but like his character, he's been in Dachau. He's this creative genius in a way, but how he does things does not fit very well into post-war America. I would give it 4.5 as well. I think like There Will Be Blood, it slightly drops the ball late on, but it's an amazing experience, especially in 70mm.
Very positive indeed. That is The Brutalist goes on general release tomorrow. It can be seen at the IFI in Dublin on 70mm. Steven Soderbergh brings us Presence, a poltergeist film with a twist in that the film is experienced from the point of view of the ghost, who seems to be causing all kinds of problems for a middle class family who have just moved into a new house that may be they can't afford. The film stars Lucy Liu as pushy mum Rebecca, only has eyes for her talented son, Tyler. We've heard that story before, I think, haven't we? Much to the heartbreak of her daughter, Chloe.
Chloe.
And this was, I think, made on 2 and 4 pence kind of thing. Soderbergh is really inventive in how he shoots the film here, Ruth.
He is. I mean, he shoots it on it's 14mm lens, so it's, you know, digital, obviously. Mm. But it so
he's used iPhones before as well.
Yeah, he has, and it's got that kind of sinuous movement of a completely mobile camera. But also the 14mm is something like we were just talking about the last one. It gives it a slightly widescreen kind of look, and therefore a kind of fisheye look. So the family's always very slightly distorted, which, I mean, the narrative, they're distorted, the narrative is so dysfunctional. And I think it's, you know, it's quite a witty film. It's not a scary film, let's just say that.
Yeah, it's not a horror.
It's not, is it? Well, it would like to be a horror, but it's not really like a horror.
But I guess Soderbergh knows what he's at.
Let's
have a listen to a clip, a family dinner. And the ghost is watching, of course, because that's what the camera is in this particular case. And the daughter, Chloe, played by Khalida Lang, is telling her father, Chris Sullivan, who plays the father, about the presence that she can feel.
Do you mean like a...
A presence?
No. Have you?
Yes.
Can you elaborate?
I'm not sure I want to.
Okay, maybe you and me can talk later.
At first I just sensed it, and then things moved.
Moved?
Yes.
What things?
A lot of things. I saw it.
You saw it? You saw things move?
I saw the aftermath. And there's a feeling I get, and sometimes it's really, really strong.
What feeling?
Athos agoraphobia.
I don't think I know that word. What does that mean?
It's the fear of being forgotten or ignored, and I can feel it. It's here. In the house.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Seriously, what the fuck?
Whoa.
I get it that you guys have to listen to this shit, but I don't. You're seeing shit.
Oh, sorry, I meant to warn you about the lovely language of the son, Tyler.
We're all offended, Chris. We're all offended.
Yeah, it's Eddie Mayday is the son, Tyler, adored by mom, but clearly a little bit of sibling rivalry between sister and brother.
Yeah, the only relationship I actually believed in the film was the father-daughter relationship, and the father, Chris, seems like a much better parent, or much more like a parent than Lucy Liu's character. I think Steven Soderbergh likes setting himself problems, like... This is set in a suburban American house. You can't go outside because it can't go outside. You're having to explain its point of view without words. And he does all that very well.
Necessity is the mother of invention, I suppose.
Well, it is if you're good. And he was going around the house in his bare in his socks, and the actors were supposed to ignore him unless otherwise specified. And he was shooting the whole thing himself.
Yeah.
And it's quite creative in that sense. And
all right.
But it's a little bit empty as well. But it's a fun watch, and it's not the opposite. It's 84 minutes or something like that.
So
it will not detain you.
Wouldn't do the two in the one day, but. Yeah,
no,
you could certainly,
no.
They're kind of anecdotes to each other. So, stars from you on this one, Paul?
I think 3.5. I enjoyed it. It's a bit slight, though.
Right.
And yeah, dead on. 3.5, too. I think it's entertaining. It's probably one for catching up on a streaming platform later.
All right. Cinemas will love you for that one.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that.
Ruth Barden and Paul Whittington there talking to us about Presence, which goes on general release tomorrow. And as I said earlier on, Brutalist goes on general release tomorrow and can be seen in 70mm at the IFI in Dublin. Belfast writer Rosemary Jenkinson is best known for her short story collections like Catholic Boy and Aphrodite's Kiss, plays including The Bonfire. But in The Memorizers, she has dipped her toe into the novel with a sweeping tale of love and treachery amid the war-torn ruins of a futuristic Belfast. Delighted that Rosemary Jenkinson is with me in studio this evening. And when we talk about this futuristic Belfast, it's a very different Belfast from the one I thought I was going to get when I started reading the novel. This was sparked off, Rosemary, by a trip you had to the front line in Ukraine. And I think it was quite a set of experiences.
Yeah, it was a frontline city of Kherson, and I've been to Kharkiv and Zaporizhia, all these cities. And obviously quite an experience. And particularly Kherson, because you have the bombs going off during the night and the window rattling the glass pane. So it was very, I mean, I had all these visions in my head of this country. And then I kind of thought, what would it be like if the war spreads right across Europe? Russian forces combined with Chinese sweep across, and of course, a nuclear war scenario. All of this, and what would it be like if Ireland was invaded?
And one of the things that I think the experience in Ukraine really feeds into the novel is this idea of when you're on the front line, I know, you know, the troubles in Belfast, sometimes walking down the street was, you were on the front line and you didn't know it. But there were, you know, there were other times when you knew where the trouble might be, or you knew what areas you might avoid at times of trouble. The thing about being on the front line in a contemporary war zone, in any war zone, is it moves. It's so malleable. You just don't know where to go and how to be safe. And drone warfare, it makes it even more so.
Indeed. And it's the randomness of the attacks. Whereas Belfast is such, it was mainly certain enclaves. And in fact, I call Belfast, I've divided it into different Enclave 1, Enclave 2, in the futuristic imagination of it. And yeah, of course it is that, we know war, which in a way made it easier for me to go to Ukraine because of Belfast War and having grown up in that time. But this is, Ukraine is a totally different, on a different scale.
And the characters that you have in this futuristic Belfast, which wouldn't be that too far off where we are now in terms of timings, you know, it could be 10, 15 years hence type of thing. Joe Elliott, it's called The Memorizers. No memory, knows nothing about, until a certain point along the way, knows nothing about troubles in Northern Ireland. What's all this about?
Yeah, that's it. I imagine this, where it's actually suppressed, our history is suppressed, in order for the country to wage perpetual war against the Russian and Chinese. It was a decision by the military commanders to say that there was no peace ever in Northern Ireland. There was no peace process. Ireland and England were always at war. So it's a kind of military, it justifies their military decisions.
And the way these people speak, they use a language called diverso lang, which is exactly as it sounds, so anesthetic that it's unbelievable. Nobody's gundering around the place. Nobody's having a wee cup of tea. Nobody's having anything with a Belfast twang off it. Everything has been neutralised. And it's not just in terms of colourful expressions. Of course, it's in terms of any type of political expression as well.
Yeah, it is. Certain dialect expressions, a lot of slang has gone, unless it's Americanized and very bland. There are no metaphors allowed. This is very much in uncertain political organizations like Stop the War have been completely suppressed. So, language, I'm always fascinated by linguistic control because I've felt that in our modern society right now that we are, particularly with things like cancellation and we have hate crime, that our words are very much monitored and policed. So I really wanted to satirise that in this novel and push that idea further.
In fact, there are thought crimes in this world. Are there word crimes?
It's word crimes.
Word crimes.
Yeah.
Thought crimes are maybe more Orwellian. Word crimes are what you get. So you say the wrong thing, that's a crime.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the Grand Commander, they, and you're very careful with the use of that pronoun, they will be after you.
Yeah, that was another thing I used. I used pronouns as a means of control, that the Grand Commander would mean, in a way, he was male and female and he was everything to the people, and that they would never question him. I think I used the they pronoun in a kind of more sinister reusage in the future. Yeah.
Jo, the young woman, she's a journalist working for the Truth Hub, so we know it's a full of lies. you don't call it the Truth Hub if it's telling the truth. But she falls in love with a soldier, and that kind of, it's not quite love across the divide, but it is the kind of the essence of the book and the dramatic tension of the book when she's put in a position where she has to make a choice between, do I shop in and survive myself, or what do I do? I don't want the audience to know.
I better not say on that. Yeah,
that's the drama of it all.
There is that. It's how are you going to save yourself, or is she going to save Scott? Is she going to save
Scott, being the boyfriend?
The boyfriend, And how is she going to get the message out about this society and how corrupt it is? And writing is a huge thing in this. It's kind of means books are banned, but there is still a possibility of writing secretly, yes, which is par. Writing is par, so that's why I use. But
and I guess I mentioned thought crimes as opposed to war crimes. There are definite Orwellian parallels in the way you tell the story here.
Very much. I mean, I love 1984. The other ones I was interested in, I kind of co-opted the ending of A Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, and also A Clockwork's Orange is in it through the dememorization process. Mm. Yes.
Well, we're going to be talking about Stanley Kubrick in a minute, so
that makes perfect
sense. Just one final thing before we go. You were talking about language and control of language. We were talking about that earlier on, obviously, in terms of Michael Longley, whose death was announced today. You knew him, and as a poet yourself, what are your memories of him? What did you think about what he did in terms of Northern Irish poetry?
He was certainly adored in Belfast. And I love the way no other writer apart from him could have written about the murder of an ice cream man and elevate it into pastoral elegy. So, you know, he had special cerebral skills. And the point is that I'd kind of met him quite a few times, and he always said that He was such a man of the people, you see, and he would say, oh, those other poets at Queen's, they all revere me and are in awe of me, but all I want really is for them to ask me to go to the pub with them.
That's a lovely story about him. And his control of language, very different from the control of language in your novel. Rosemary, thanks for coming in to talk to us about it this evening. Rosemary Jenkson talking about her debut novel. Didn't get to tease her about the fact that she said she'd never write one, but now she has. The Memorizers is the title. It's published by Arlen House, and it is distributed by
Argosy.
Distributed by Argosy. Thanks very much, Rosemary.
Thank you, Sean.
When Barry Lyndon was released in December 1975, it arrived with all the hallmarks of a prestige project. The vision of Stanley Kubrick, fresh off the controversy of A Clockwork Orange, which Rosemary Jenkinson was just talking about, in fact. A major star was involved in this, Barry Lyndon, that is, Ryan O'Neill, and a breathtaking recreation of the 18th century brought to life with groundbreaking cinematography. Yet, despite its ambition and artistry, the film was met with lukewarm reviews and box office indifference over time, of course, as often happens, and it certainly did in the case of Barry Lyndon. There was a remarkable transformation in public and critical opinion, and it is now regarded as Kubrick's crowning achievements. This richly detailed tale of ambition, greed and human frailty stands as a testament to Kubrick's visual storytelling, his exploration of human nature. Turns 50 this month, the film, and I'm joined in studio this evening by John McGuire to look at how Kubrick made Barry Lyndon and its connection to Ireland.
Mm. How are you, Sean?
Not too bad. And a nice, he takes a nice little William Thackeray novel, you know, a big doorstopper of a thing. But did this come after Clockwork Orange?
Clockwork Orange, yeah. And it was a reaction, I suppose, Kubrick at the time. Clockwork Orange was a very successful film, but it attracted a lot of tabloid controversy. And Kubrick himself found himself vilified daily in the tabloid press. And as a result of that and some violent acts that were attributed to copycat attacks, you know, supposedly recreated things that had been seen in Clockwork Orange, he decided to withdraw the film from circulation. So it was in an act of self-censorship. And then he kind of withdrew himself from circulation and took himself off to his manor, Chiswick Manor, in the countryside in England, and attracted this kind of recluse persona.
And I think he wanted to stay there in terms of making the movie. What brought him to Ireland? Because, of course, we love the connection that we have with...
Well, I think Ken Adam was his production designer for Barry Lyndon. He'd also done Dr. Strangelove. Mm. And Adam was looking around. They spent about a year in Ireland, Adam and his team.
Kubrick's daughter was involved in the location.
In the location, scouting as well. And they went to every stately home, every grand park, every estate that they could find in Ireland. And Kubrick liked what he was seeing. He liked the price of it. He had a relatively limited budget. He liked how much further his money would go in Ireland as well. And the fact that he could have, you know, a large number of extras, and he could bring all his technicians with him, and he could base himself in Dublin Castle when he was shooting in Dublin and down in Waterford when the unit moved to Waterford.
And of course that kind of the British feel of parts of those counties was...
England didn't look like that anymore. Yes, yeah. England looked more like Milton Keynes, and that was no good to Kubrick. And also the fact that he could... the film, obviously, and we'll get on a little bit about the story. It's an Irish story. It is an Irish story
about
the experience of moving into Europe.
Yeah,
and I think he wanted to be here for that.
But the Barry Lyndon of is the Ryan O'Neill character who is what's his actual name? He goes on
Redmond Barry.
We know we're in. That's a good rebel Irish name, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing, and it's this evocation. Kubrick, after A Clockwork Orange, wanted to make Napoleon. Napoleon collapsed because there was a Dino De Laurentiis produced film called Waterloo, which was an absolute box office bomb. So they wouldn't give him the money to make his Napoleon film. So he funneled all of this exhaustive research that he had done into the Thackeray novel, William Makepeace Thackeray's 1844 novel, The Luck of Barry Lyndon, often referred to as a novel without a hero. And that attracted Kubrick as well. Mm. And he set himself the challenge of representing the past and the 200-year-old past as accurately as he could on screen, both historically and visually. And that is no mean feat. And the film is a testament to that, what the Marvel kids nowadays would call world building. And it's almost invisible, Sean, when you're watching the film, but it is a complete and entire evocation of a long gone past.
Let's have a listen to a clip on this. We need to know that there's a woman involved here and there's a duel involved here and Ryan O'Neill is in love. That's
about the size of it.
That's as much plot as you need to know.
The picaresque is that there really isn't any point in racing through the plot here because as a picaresque, something new happens in a glacially slow movie of over 3 hours, but something is always happening, and the movement and the momentum is always moving forward.
Let's have a listen to this clip then that features the great Godfrey Quigley, one of the great stage actors in Ireland. He's playing a character here called Captain Brogan, and he's encouraging the Bow Redmond Barry, also known as Barry Lyndon, the Ryan O'Neill character, to apologise and head off to Dublin rather than take part in a duel with Captain Quinn, played by Leonard Rosser in a way you've never seen.
One of Kubrick's favourite actors. Loved him as an actor. You
know. Let's have a listen.
Now, Dublin's a fine place. And if you've a mind to take a ride there and see the town for a month, here's 10 guineas at your service. Will that satisfy you, Captain Quinn?
Yes, if Mr. Barry will apologise and go to Dublin, I will consider the whole affair honourably settled.
Say you're sorry, Redmond. Go on, you can easily say that.
I'm not sorry. And I'll not apologise. And I... soon go to Dublin as to hell.
There you go. Ryan O'Neill is sooner going to Dublin. He'd sooner go to Dublin than to hell. Captain Quinn was played by Leonard Rossiter. Captain Grogan played by Godfrey Quigley. We can't talk, John McGuire, about Barry Lyndon without talking about the look of it. And particularly, now, it was shot outdoors in Ireland. So they were dealing with natural light,
but the interiors
were all shot in candlelight, which of course is not quite old hat now, but this was like...
No, it's still a real challenge.
And
the film wouldn't have
happened
at all. This was Kubrick's bottom line. Number one, he didn't necessarily want Ryan O'Neill. He wanted Robert Redford. That didn't happen. Redford didn't want the part because he had this Irish ancestry and the red hair. So O'Neill got the part. But the film wouldn't have happened at all if Kubrick couldn't figure out a way to shoot by candlelight. And he collaborated with NASA and with the cinematographer John Alcott, who would go on to win an Oscar for it, to develop a way to attach these special low-light, super-fast lenses. If any photographers are listening, it's a f0.7 stop. It's as open as a massive aperture in order to attach those to a Panavision film camera in order to capture the interior scenes lit only by candles. Now, Kubrick cheated slightly in that his candles were kind of special candles. Mm. They had three wicks. They burned really, really quickly. If you look at the film, you'll notice that most of the candles are burnt all the way down. So he had extra light,
yeah,
but it was still only candlelight.
Yeah,
there
them.
Are a few scenes where they use an exterior, like a film light outside, yeah, in order to give you a bit of extra boost interior for daylight scenes.
In terms of costumes and all the rest of it, it was the same thing. They went to museums. They went.
This is Kubrick,
to get,
Sean. This
they,
is
they didn't want to make things.
The exhaustive detail.
Yeah,
everything was absolutely perfect as it was. And like I said about world building, when we're watching this, we barely notice that the furniture is absolutely period correct. That the painting, the paint on the walls, the wallpaper, the paintings that they walk through in all of these grand houses, everything is as perfect and as it should have been, as it's humanly possible to do. They shot for 300 plus days.
$11 million
was the reported budget, but it was almost twice the budget that he had been given by Warner Brothers, who in fairness stood by Kubrick throughout his career and funded everything that he wanted to do,
because well, they knew he was doing special things.
But the effect of all of this, Sean, is magical. In order to recreate the past, to use cinema as a time machine, that's what Kubrick is trying to do here. He's trying to bring us into this story, a fictional story based on a real guy, actually. Thackeray was inspired by a real person. A real Irish rogue and adventurer in his story. But in order to use cinema as a time machine, to create something that... And nobody wanted to see it, Sean, this is the thing.
Well,
at the time...
We'll talk about how that changed, but we have to... Oh, of course, it wouldn't be a film shot in Ireland if there wasn't a wee bit of Kyobai-ish stuff going on.
Yeah.
Ryan O'Neill, in this clip, is talking to Malcolm McDowell in 2012 about the production of Barry Lyndon in Ireland and a few little threats that came their way.
I loved Ireland. I thought it was a wonderful place, but there were IRA incidences going on, and we were a British company. We had to change all our plates on our car. I wore an American flag shirt around just so they'd not confuse me with the actual Irish. And they were threatening. They were threatening, and they did threaten Stanley's family. And they even came to the door, and the maid said, "Don't let them in. Those aren't painters." They said, "We're here to paint. We're here to paint." And she said, "They're not painters. Don't let them in." So he jumped on a ship and fled back to England. He used the alias Robert Newton. And he said, "We'll have to we'll start the picture again back in England. We're out of here."
Some of that is new information to me.
Yeah,
Sean.
Well, I would say never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Yeah, I know
would
this
be
is
part
the yarn,
of what I would
yep.
think about that. However, it did. You know, you said it was panned by the critics at the time. But what changed? When did the movement come from "What is this all about?" into "This is a masterpiece"?
That is an excellent question. And I don't really have a ready answer for you, because there's not a formula here. There are great films that are forgotten and that don't get revisited, are not reevaluated, and aren't shown again. I think I've only seen Barry Lyndon. I've seen it many times, but I've only actually ever seen it projected once. And I think that that's the key to it. I saw it in the Phoenix Cinema in Dingle years ago at the film festival in Dingle. And I was struck by a number of things. First of all, just how glorious it is to see it big and bright on a cinema screen, but also how funny it is. The audience that I was watching it with were laughing along because it is pretty funny. There's a lot of really good gags in it.
It's not two-stage Irish-y either.
Oh, God, no. No, not at all.
It doesn't go that route at all.
Because he cast it perfectly. Yeah. The cast all the way through, particularly Arthur O'Sullivan, Captain Feeney. That's an extraordinary scene early on. But to get back to your point, how does it come about that films that have been forgotten or overlooked are reevaluated? There isn't a clear answer, but I will say that the very influential critic in the US, Roger Ebert, included it in one of his great books, great film books, and it was slowly then started to build momentum after that. But you know, films like this come along so rarely, Sean, that it would have been a crying shame.
Well, 50 years since it came along. 50 years, so yeah. We're talking with John Maguire there, marking the 50th anniversary of Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. It was released 50 years ago this month, in fact, and that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields researched, Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Stay safe now, obviously, and follow all the warnings between now and tomorrow, and look after yourselves in the meantime. I hope to be back here tomorrow night, all things being well, but do look after yourselves and do what you're told over the next 24 hours. And Ray Cudahy will be with you after the news.